Tax Update Number 59 for Saturday, May 13, 2006. It's tea time. Exceptions to the early distribution penalty under Section 72T. Welcome to Tax Update for Saturday, May 13, 2006. This week, the early distribution penalty under Section 72T. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon any of the positions presented. The podcast and the document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast, and such a prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of the CPE presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information for tax practitioners. You can subscribe to their services at www.lineburgservices.com. Well, this week we are going to take a look at a couple of cases that came down in summary tax court opinions, and they're interesting because we have one winner and one loser. We're also going to look at the broader topic that each of these cases covered, and that is the exception for early distribution from retirement plans to get out of the penalties for the 10% extra tax that is imposed on those premature distributions. Now, the issue becomes one that ensnares taxpayers quite often because, unfortunately, this is one of those areas that is more complicated than it needs to be. Congress, in their infinite wisdom, has provided multiple ways to save for retirement. Those ways to save for retirement include qualified retirement plans like employer 401ks, defined benefit plans, and the like. They include the individual retirement accounts, of which we have a couple of variants, the traditional, the Roth IRA, and then the not-to-be-forgotten simple IRA that combines the employer plan along with the employee's own personal account. Each of these accounts is subject to their own special rules for when an early distribution will be accepted from the 10% penalty. The key problem is, while they share many exceptions, there also are exceptions that are unique to the various types of accounts, and taxpayers quite often get tripped up over this. As well, some of the exceptions are not necessarily clear as to when they apply. And in the second case we're going to look at this week, we'll note with a taxpayer who is looking at the disability exception to the early distribution penalties and the IRS's view of how that should have been interpreted as well as the tax courts. And frankly, I misspoke there. I called it a penalty. If you look at Section 72, while it certainly looks like a penalty, sounds like a penalty, and I will probably trip up more than once and call it a penalty, in reality, it is phrased as a 10% addition to your tax. Under Section 72T, you're stuck with a 10% extra tax on your distributions. And you're stuck with that unless you meet an exception. Now, the point of this provision was to discourage taxpayers from using these accounts for a purpose that wasn't retirement related. But then Congress decided that, well, in certain cases, it would be okay to go ahead and use them for a purpose that wasn't retirement, and that's why we look at now the special exceptions to the distribution. Unfortunately, it's apparently okay only if it comes from certain accounts and certain occasions, or it's only okay if you meet certain hurdles, and that's what we'll be looking at. The confusion over the types of exceptions that apply to each type of plan has caught taxpayers more than once. And in today's podcast, we're going to discuss the Domanico case, a taxpayer who attempted to figure out by reading the Master Tax Guide what exceptions applied to her distribution from her 401k plan from her former employer, and who unfortunately got it wrong. In the second case, we're going to take a look at, as I mentioned earlier, the exception for distributions related to disability. And the problem in the Rideau case was what exactly constituted a disability that gave rise to the exception under Section 72. Now, the 10% tax itself is found in Section 72 T1. And note, the way it is phrased, the 10% extra addition to tax applies to every distribution from a retirement plan. It is one of those cases in the law that we see quite often. In the tax law, a structure that Congress likes to use is to have a position that applies to everything and then go down through a bit of exceptions. Why that structure is used is it means that the default is it is in. You have to find something to get it out of this coverage. So when we start with a distribution from a retirement plan, before we know anything else, it is in the 10% penalty and subject to the penalty. How do we get out of the penalty? Well, there's a list of exceptions beginning at 72T. The one we're all aware of, and in fact the one we quite often shortcut because we call this a premature distribution penalty, is found at 72T2 cap A little I. On that one tells us any distribution made on or after the date on which the employee, an employee may be the IRA plan holder, if it's an IRA, that gets defined later, attains age 59 and a half. So if they're over age 59 and a half, we have a qualifying distribution from our retirement plan, and therefore we're not subject to the 10% penalty. That's the big exception that we're all used to, and that's the one that Congress put in to hopefully have you hold on to these funds to your retirement age. Somehow in Congress's infinite wisdom, they decided that someone must live 59 years and 6 months before they are eligible for retirement. Why that extra 6 months was added probably had to do with meeting a budget goal at some point, but we have the age 59 and a half rule. Now, after that, we have a number of exceptions. The next one in line is if it's made to a beneficiary on or after the death. Death one, well, that's fine. If it's attributable to the employees being disabled within the meaning of Section M7, that's one we'll discuss here later. The next one is a part of substantially equal periodic payments. That particular exception we're not going to go into in detail here today, except I will just note that is a rather complex area, to put it mildly. And if you have a taxpayer who wants to take substantially equal payments, there are a lot of planning issues you're going to need to work through there, as well as some warnings you better put in writing to the taxpayer so down the line we don't get a question of, well, you didn't tell me that I could be subjected retroactively to all these penalties, and I can't believe you screwed up that badly, and I think you should pay for the penalty. So, fair warning if you're looking at substantially equal payments. Next exception, found at 2 cap AV, is a payment made to an employee after separation from service after attainment of age 55. The special case dropping below the age 59 and a half rule requires separation from service after the attainment of age 55. Those two will get you out. Next, dividends paid with respect to stock of a corporation, which are described in Section 404K. Those are those special dividends that also aren't subject to the qualified dividend rate. There are various oddball rules there, but those are the employer securities in the plan. Or a distribution for AVII made on account of a levy under Section 6331 on the qualified retirement plan. So if the payment is made on account of a levy, we get out there. That was nice of the IRS or the Congress to give us that one. When they're taking it, when they're forcing it out, they'll say, okay, fine, we'll give away the 10%. Now that's our initial list. Then we have a couple of extra and special ones. Medical expenses are found at T2B. It got its own little division. Distributions made to the employee other than distributions described in subparagraphs A, C, or D, to the extent such distributions do not exceed the amount allowable as deduction under Section 213. Section 72T2C provides that payments regards to qualified domestic relations orders are also not subject to the 10% penalty. That is, a distribution to an alternate payee pursuant to a qualified domestic relations order is not subjected to the 10% penalty. Section 72T2D tells us that distributions from an individual retirement plan, aha, this one was limited, to an individual after separation from employment for health insurance if you meet certain conditions, those are allowable and out of the 10% extra add-on to the tax. We go, basically, we also go on now to the next one, 72T2E, the distributions from the IRA, again, it must be from an IRA, for higher education expenses. This is the issue we're going to talk about in the first case today. The problem here, realize it only applies to IRAs. And 72T2F, another IRA-only exception, distributions from certain plans, and then it goes on to certain plans means individual retirement plans, for qualified first-time homeowner distributions. And as we know, and as if you look at the definition, first-time homeowner does not necessarily mean someone who's never owned a home. But that's also a wonderful example of how the definitions inside the code are not necessarily going to be definitions that are going to make sense outside the code. In many cases, the code self-references itself, references internally to its own set of definitions. This particular first-time homebuyer rule is a clear one of an inside reference. We're also going to look at more detail at the inside reference for what is disabled, because that's also defined inside of this provision and inside of the code for this purpose. Now, as noted, there were three that were limited to individual retirement accounts: health insurance during periods of unemployment, higher education expenses, and first-time home purchases. Those three types of distributions, if made from an IRA account, are considered exceptions to the 10% early distribution penalty. If those amounts come from an employer retirement plan, and that would include a KEO plan, one thing that quite often I find people get confused about is some idea that a KEO plan is somehow distinct and separate from an employer retirement plan. In reality, for a number of years now, for all practical purposes, a KEO plan and a retirement plan of a corporate entity are the same beast for these purposes. Therefore, realize if you take a distribution from your IRA account, even if that was a SEP-funded IRA account, to pay for first-time homeowner purchases, that's fine. It can pay for higher education expenses, that's fine. Unemployment, that's fine. However, if you took your distribution not from your SEP account, but from your KEO account that was funded with contributions, those are not eligible for these exceptions. Where taxpayers foul this up quite often is by not taking their distribution, because in most cases we find when this happens, taxpayers have left employment, they're going back to school, for instance, and they take the distribution from the employer and use that to pay the educational expenses. And then they'll take the rest of the money from the distribution and roll that into the IRA because they had got a complete distribution. What the taxpayers should do is take the complete distribution from the employer, place that into an IRA account, then from the IRA account take the distribution and pay the education expenses. That tactic works. The first one doesn't. Is that absurd? No question. Is it required? Absolutely. The courts have been very clear that you cannot shortcut that process. The courts point out Congress has made it clear what does and doesn't qualify. The courts do not have the ability to rewrite clear language of the code, and this is very clear language of what applies and what doesn't. You need to counsel your clients who are thinking of taking distributions that they need to make sure they route this correctly. This is not something that's going to be fixed after the fact. This is a case where it's very important your clients understand they talk to you before they make any significant transactions, and that includes anything related to a distribution from the retirement plan of their employer. Now, well, it looked pretty good reading through the list from IRA standpoints, because the only thing we saw listed that didn't apply was things that didn't apply, the things that applied only for IRAs. So does that mean IRAs get all the other exceptions? No. Section 72T3A, Congress was teasing you by bearing this down a little further so you'd have to keep reading, tells us of those things that don't apply to an individual retirement plan. And the ones in question that do not are separation from service after attainment of age 55. Any payment made for that purpose does not qualify for the 10% penalty exception. As well, quadro payments. Those cannot come from an IRA as accepted. We can divide an IRA in divorce, but you can't take the money and run. At least you can't take the money and run and not get stuck with a 10% penalty. So it is a problem we need to be aware of. Clients have to watch in those cases. How do clients screw these exceptions up? Well, there's a couple of ways, and it's really a more general problem. Many of these exceptions apply, in some cases, are triggered by the plan internally. Where we get into a problem is when a taxpayer takes his post-age 55 distribution from the plan, can't decide if he wants to leave any of it out and pay tax on it or not, so he initially rolls the entire balance to the IRA account, or enrolls the entire balance to the IRA account because the Human Resources Department told him that if he does that, then there won't be any of this withholding on the distribution. The 20% won't come off. So he goes ahead and says, put the whole thing in the IRA account, and then decides, well, I need 10 grand. I'm going to take 10 grand out. It's not attained age 50, and it's not attained age 59 and a half, is over age 55. If he does it that way, he is going to be paying the 10% penalty because the distribution from the IRA account will not gain this special exception. Similarly, if there's a quadro payment, you can't move it into an IRA account and then decide, oh, I didn't mean that. A related got you. Remember, there are distributions to the beneficiary on the death. If, however, we have an IRA account where the spouse goes ahead and takes it as her own, then at that point we've now converted and we make it into our IRA, and now we're not really taking it as a beneficiary in a death distribution, we're taking it as our own distribution, and we are now subject to the 10% penalty. If it had come out based upon a death distribution, not subject. These are all the various areas where we can stumble into the 10% penalties. Taxpayers who roll over distributions that potentially could have escaped the 10% penalty need to talk with you before they do the rollover if they do believe they're going to have a need to get any of those funds out of the plan, and if whether we shouldn't take them out now before we get to age 59 and a half so we can escape the penalty provisions, the 10%, rather than potentially pushing it into the future but having to get tripped up with the 10% penalty. It's a planning issue. It depends upon how long it's going to be before that distribution would be made, but it is something the client has to talk with you before they complete the rollover. Now let's go on to what we've got as two cases this week. In the first case of Domanico, we have a taxpayer who is trapped by the fact that education expenses are an item that is only accepted if the distribution has come from an individual retirement account, and do not qualify for exceptions if the amount comes from a qualified plan. Now, Linda Domanico had previously been employed by TWA as a flight attendant. She suffered an injury while at TWA that prevented her from continuing work as a flight attendant, and she went back to graduate school, later being employed as a librarian. Well, it turns out in the library they had copies of the Master Tax Guide. That will prove to be a potential problem as Linda works on this. In 2001, she received a letter from TWA. TWA at that time was being acquired by American Airlines. And because of that acquisition, they were terminating out the plan, and TWA wrote and told Linda that she was eligible to receive the distribution of her account balance. And TWA offered her all the options. It could go into an IRA. It can go wherever, you know, you wish. You could transfer it to another plan if that works. Linda decided, I've got all these education expenses because I'm paying for all this graduate school work. I've both got graduate school work that I have done before, that I have debt to pay. I have the current year's graduate school tuition that I have debt to pay on, and I'm going to be doing this for a couple more years, so I want to go ahead and pay that stuff off too. I'm going to need to pay that up too. So she said, I'm going to take my distribution and dedicate it to my education. So she took the check from TWA, did not transfer it to an IRA account, but instead used it to pay various education expense. Now she decided that was a good tactic because she went and decided she's got graduate education, she's a librarian, she's literate, she's able to read, and she got the Master Tax Guide, CCH's Master Tax Guide, and read their provisions on what an early distribution is accepted from the 10% extra penalty and when it would work. Now, the key provisions that she found in the Master Tax Guide were in paragraph 2179 of the year she had, and it told us that distributions from a traditional IRA to a participant before the individual has reached age 59 and a half are generally subject to the same 10% penalty that applies to early distribution for qualified plans. Many of the exceptions to the early distribution penalty also apply to early distributions from a traditional IRA. Now, that went on and made that statement. Then it goes on and says later on, the following exceptions to the 10% penalty also apply when early distributions are made from an IRA. And in this case, it said education expenses, and it talks about the 10% penalty not applying there. Now, those of us who go back and read the sections in question will understand how the mistake was made when she was interpreting it. What CCH was talking about was basically the structure we saw in that code section of here are all the ones that are kind of applied to the qualified plan. And then, oh yeah, also if it's an IRA, you can get these. So that's why they were set out in a separate section in the book. But Linda didn't realize that was the point. She read it and she interpreted it to mean that, well, it also apply. That means that also seems to her to imply, well, it must apply to something other than an IRA as well, and that that also must mean it applied to the qualified plan. So based upon her interpretation of the IRA rules, she believed that, in fact, based upon CCH's explanation, that the qualified plan and the IRA each would qualify for the exception from the 10% early distribution penalty if she used her funds for education expenses. Moreover, she thought that according to her, as the court said, a one-time distribution should cover expenses incurred over a number of years because paragraph 2179 of the Master Tax Guide does not state that the funds must be used in the same calendar year the distribution is received. Well, Linda got a lot from the Master Tax Guide. Unfortunately, the Master Tax Guide is not the tax law. And unfortunately, the Master Tax Guide, and this is true and something that we have to remember as practitioners, is this is not a document that is meant to be interpreted on its own. This is an interpretation already. So rather than trying to expand it, you have to realize this is meant to explain something. So if I have a real question about what CCH means, I don't try to reason from their statement. I have to go back and take a look at the supporting item in question, in this case, the code section, and see, well, what were they talking about? And when you figure out the way they were trying to explain this, looking at the code itself, it's obvious what they were trying to do. And at that point, it becomes pretty obvious how you should interpret this section. Unfortunately, Linda didn't have the benefit of having accounting training. That wasn't her background. She was not an accountant, nor was she an attorney. She didn't have the benefit of any of this training. Rather, she had to just try to work with this on her own and try to make sense of what doesn't really make a lot of sense by reading along and trying to prepare her return. And she was conscientious. She was really trying to figure out how this works. The tax court actually had quite a bit of sympathy for Linda, but still pointed out there are some problems. First, they noted it's well settled that the authoritative sources of federal tax law are the statutes, regulations, and judicial decisions, and not guides such as the Master Tax Guides that are published by private commercial publishers. The court then went on to note that what the law says is relevant to the matter. The court note, lastly, as relevant herein, the 10% additional tax imposed on early distribution from qualified retirement plans does not apply to distribution from individual retirement plan used for higher education expenses of the taxpayer for the taxable year. See Section 72(t)(2)(e). An individual retirement plan is defined as individual retirement account or individual retirement annuity, commonly referred to as IRAs. Retirement plans qualified under Section 401A and K, however, are not included in the definition of individual retirement plan under Section 7701A-37. The court goes on to note, clearly, Congress intended this exception to apply only to distribution from individual retirement plans, that is, IRAs, and not to qualified plans. Now, the court goes on and includes a commentary that says, we understand what you're doing. We understand how you got here. We know that you were trying to get this right. And we know that this is something that's arguably confusing. As the court said, although we acknowledge that petitioner used the 401k plan distribution for a laudable purpose, absent some constitutional effect, we are constrained to apply the law as written. The court goes on to note, as the court often does here, accordingly, petitioner's appeal for relief must in this instance, be addressed to their elected representatives. Now, clearly, had she merely put her IRA distribution, put her distribution into an IRA first, then taken an IRA distribution to pay her current year education expenses, there wouldn't have been a problem. Now, when she tried to roll in her old debt and also apparently do some other work and hold some money and pay debts, pay items in the future, she ran into a problem that another taxpayer in Lauder Beckett versus Commissioner, TC Memo 2005-162, last July ran into. The education expenses, you can't kind of pay off the old debts all at once. That's another issue, though, for another day and another area of confusion in the tax law. Well, that was a loser for the taxpayer. She was a pro se taxpayer, represented herself, summary case. And quite honestly, in most cases, pro se taxpayers in summary cases lose. What I always find interesting is when we have a case that is a pro se taxpayer, meaning a taxpayer without legal representation, who wins the case in the summary opinions. And we have one in Rideau versus Commissioner, TC Summary 2006-74. That case turned on whether the taxpayer qualified for the exception from the penalty for being disabled. The exception refers to a definition of disabled found in Section 72M7. 72M7 reads that for purposes of this section, meaning Section 72, an individual shall be considered to be disabled if he is unable to engage in any substantial gainful activity by reason of any medically determinable physical or mental impairment which can be expected to result in death or to be of long continued and indefinite duration. An individual shall not be considered to be disabled unless he furnishes proof of the existence thereof in such form and manner as the Secretary may require. Well, obviously, we have to look at Mr. Rideau's facts. Mr. Rideau was employed as a boiler mechanic for 20 years by Southern California Edison. Now, the court went on and described his job as essentially he had to maintain the power generating stations, and he had to do a lot of heavy work, heavy lifting. Court notes, when working on a boiler, he was required to lift large pieces of metal with his co-workers that weighed between 250 and 300 pounds. Petitioner's responsibility included, among other things, replacing valves, doing boiler overhauls, welding on a steel platform on his knees, and constructing parts for maintenance of the power plant. So the taxpayer in this question had a very physically demanding job. Now, he sustained a bunch of injuries related to his job that the court outlined in their facts. He basically had a history of physical injuries that he sustained while working for Southern California Edison. Not surprisingly, when you're bouncing around with 300-pound pieces of metal quite often. In 97, he had surgery for his back. I should say in 87, he had surgery for his back. In 89, he noticed pain in his left shoulders while performing his job duty. He was diagnosed with bursitis, shoulder tendonitis, which was likely a cause of the repetitive use of the upper extremity with all this lifting, pushing, pulling, and all the other stuff he had to do. Since then, he had been self-treating with various medications as well as application of heat and ice, and in 2003, he received an injection of steroids for his left shoulder to ease the pain. In February 2001, he had a work-related injury to his left knee. He had knee surgery, took a leave of absence, and has not worked since his knee injury in 2001. Although he has a full range of motion for the left knee, he suffers pain to his knee with movement and weight-bearing. As a result of the knee injury, he began to have complications with his back, and he received a series of epidural steroid injections to ease the pain to his lumbar spine. And in 2003, if things weren't bad enough, he was diagnosed with arthritis in the left knee, lumbar radiculopathy, how was that, pain in the lower extremities, epidural fibrosis of the lumbar spine, that is scar tissue near the nerve spot, obesity, and a left shoulder rotator cuff tear. I'll get that one out. Some of these physical ailments were stemmed from or are related to the injuries you suffered in earlier years. So this is a cumulative effect. A lot of things were going wrong with our gentleman, Mr. Rideau, in this case. Now, he took some steps that went on during his treatment. The court described that. Due to his knee injury, he gained 40 pounds from inactivity. He had been a very active gentleman, and obviously his activity level dropped rather substantially with all of these injuries. His weight exacerbated the knee and back pain. That's a negative effect, unfortunately, of gaining weight, which hampered his recovery. He recommended he participate in a weight loss program. He went to physical therapy 3 times a week and was required to engage in a home exercise program. He was also asked to limit his weight-bearing lifting and bending activities. He went for an orthopedic reevaluation every 6 weeks to track the progress of his recovery. Now, in a letter dated January 20th of 2006, his primary physician advised that he had been treating this gentleman for work-related injuries from March of 2002 to December 2005 for a left rotator cuff tear, left knee arthritis, and the lumbar radiculopathy. However you pronounce that, I will leave that to the physicians in the audience. The doctor further advised that the physician was considered temporarily totally disabled from March 2002 to December 2005. Now, that temporarily is going to become an issue that we have to deal with here. During the period he was on leave due to his injuries, Mr. Rideau was offered, and he accepted, which seems to make a lot of sense given what was going on, an early retirement package from his employer. He was 50 years old at the time he received his distribution. Key fact, because he's under the age 55 limit, he's under age 59 and a half. So his distribution is not going to get out of the 10% penalty based upon his age. We're going to have to find another exception. He reported the distribution on his Form 1040, and he filled out Form 5329 and indicated clearly that he was accepted from the additional tax and related distribution because of full disability. So he reported everything on the return, and he actually filled in the 5329 and indicated this is not subject to penalty because I was disabled. Now, the IRS examined Mr. Rideau's return. Part of the reason they examined it, to be honest, is because his 1099-R from the retirement plan had indicated that it was a premature distribution, no known exception to the penalty. That started the ball rolling, and as we'll find, the IRS thought that was a very, very important fact. Now, the court noted that this whole case turns on the definitions defined in the code in Section 72M7, and in Regulation 1.72-17F, the IRS expands upon what exactly it means to be disabled. Now, basically, the regulations set forth a number of general considerations about determination of disability that talk about the nature of the severity of the impairment. And the regulations also, the court points out, emphasize the substantial gainful activity to which 72M7 refers as the activity or a comparable activity in which the individual customarily engaged prior to the arising of the disability. The fact that Mr. Rideau, for instance, perhaps could now do a desk job or could do some other task that didn't involve lifting was not the issue here for disability. The question was he unable to perform his traditional activity or something comparable? Therefore, the court notes, you have to evaluate this in terms of whether it does in fact prevent him from engaging in his customary or any comparable gainful activity, considering his education, training, and work experience. Did he really have something he could go to? While Mr. Rideau, no question, could have been a certified public accountant or an attorney, do those works, he wasn't really in a position to go out and suddenly become an attorney or to suddenly become a CPA doing tax practice the next day. Mr. Rideau did not have the training, background, and work experience that would allow him to basically switch over. So we had to look at him in terms of a long and experienced boiler mechanic. Could he still basically be gainfully employed in that area? Now, the IRS did place a lot of emphasis on that 1099-R and saying there was no known exception. The court, I thought, was kind. It noted the point and then just never mentioned it again, which it shouldn't. In many ways, this is the same problem we had in the earlier case of Domanico. The fact that a third party, a private third party, said, oh, no known exception, that's not a binding determination of what happened. Rather, the actual facts of the case as applied to the law determine whether or not Mr. Rideau was disabled. At best, you might argue that that code indicated that the employer didn't believe he was disabled, but my guess is it doesn't mean anything at all, except it meant that some clerk in the plan department for the employer in question simply went ahead and put that code on everything because that was the easiest way to get the 1099s out of the system. The court then looked at the real issue. Was he disabled in the fashion the law required? And the court goes on to note a number of facts. It says, according to the medical evaluations from his physicians during 2003, he experienced pain whenever he moved or shifted weight onto his left knee. As a result, he was unable to return to work because he could not lift heavy objects. Even had he not retired, the evidence shows that the petitioner's injuries were such he could no longer perform his job. So there was no question in 2003 he couldn't do his job. He wasn't going to be able to lift 250, 300-pound objects and move them around and do the other heavy work and be down on his knees doing the work he had to do. But that still may not be enough if his injury is not indefinite, if it is a temporary injury, and the regulations use the example of someone who breaks a bone in their arm. Well, you know, if you broke your arm, you also wouldn't probably be able to be lifting 300-pound items right away. But that's expected to mend within the foreseeable future, and once it mends, you could go back to lifting your 300-pound objects. So the court said, well, what does indefinite mean? And actually, the reg itself is not really defined well as to what it means by indefinite. It said, you know, we kind of said if it's indefinite, it counts, the reg says, but it never really explains. So the court said, well, you know, while there's not a lot of case law and not a lot of things talking about indefinite in this context, there is a question about temporarily, about whether something was temporary. And, you know, if it's temporary, then it's not going to be the indefinite duration, and then we won't get it. Well, is that what the doctor meant? And do we have to take his tag that he was temporarily disabled to mean that Mr. Rideau could not meet the disability requirements of Code Section 72M7? And the court said, well, let's look at what temporary means. And the best thing they found as an analogy was saying, you know, we have a lot of litigation for what are temporary away from home expenses under Section 162. And the court notes there that in that case, employment is for indefinite duration if its termination is not foreseeable or not reasonably expected to be foreseen within a reasonable or reasonably short period of time. The court also notes a number of cases have held that the mere labeling or designation of the job as temporary is not determinative. The duration of the job is indefinite as termination is not foreseeable within a short period of time. And that something is temporary in the beginning may become indefinite due to a change in circumstances or simply the passage of time. The court then applies this rationale to Mr. Rideau. Similarly, although petitioner's injuries were labeled as temporary, there was no reasonable indication, nor could it be reasonably anticipated or be foreseen at the time of petitioner's distribution 2003, when or if the petitioner would ever be able to return to work. Even if his injuries were temporary initially, over time they became indefinite. The inability to predict when petitioner would be able to return to work, if ever, caused the disability to be indefinite within the meaning of Code Section 72M7 and Section 1.72-17AF3 of the Income Tax Regulations. The court held that because the real problem here was we don't know when he's going to get better, we can't reasonably expect when he would be able to return to work. Therefore, the court decided this looked to them like an indefinite disability. And we had already agreed he was disabled. Therefore, if it's indefinite, he qualifies and he gets the exception. So for this point, the IRS was told that, sorry, you're not going to get the 10% tax here. We are siding with the petitioner, that is the taxpayer, and the penalty exception applies. Now, a couple of observations and caveats are in order for this particular case. First, the case does illustrate it's important to move beyond codes on things like Forms 1099 and the like in analyzing how the tax law applies to a taxpayer. Mere fact that the form said no penalty exception applies doesn't mean no penalty exception applies. I will note that the wording of the form itself even says no known exception. That doesn't mean that there may not be exceptions that the person who filled out the 1099 doesn't know about. The employer is not responsible for knowing every potential exception that might work in this case. So basically, you have to look beyond the facts. You can't just blindly accept whatever the code is in the box on the 1099. Had that been done, or had Mr. Rideau done that, he would have paid the 10% penalty. Now, the case also illustrates the reality that if you don't go along with the default treatment, the computer is going to kick out that CP2000 notice, and you're going to be in discussions with the IRS about this matter very likely. That's a reality you have to deal with. But it does not change the fact that the law is still the law, the application of the law is still the application of the law, and that depends on the actual facts in play. The issue you have to discuss with your client is the expectation that the IRS, due to the coding of that 1099, may very well come back and dispute the matter or have correspondence, and we need to be ready for it. But if we're talking about a large penalty, it's probably worth doing the dispute. Second, please note, this is a very fact-specific case. The exact fact of Mr. Rideau's injuries, the exact facts of what happened, were incredibly important. You cannot use a fact-specific case like this to just blindly apply to the next thing that comes by. When you have a fact-specific case, you have to look at it as more a general guide as to what went on. As well, this case is even less useful that way because we have a tax court summary opinion, not cited as precedent, not technically supposed to be since it's not subject to appeal. It's essentially a case that realistically you can't use in the next case, at least officially. In reality, you can use it much the same way you would use a letter ruling that somebody else had obtained. And the way you use that is you're going to say the legal analysis is still valid. We're still looking at the analysis of the law. And here, in this fact pattern with these facts, here is what the tax court judge decided was the proper legal analysis. So, agent, if you want to say that's not the proper analysis, that's all fine and good. But we're going to discuss with the fact that obviously there's a real question here and we think we should go forward if we want to keep disputing the matter. So the case does have a usefulness there. Just realize it's not as useful as if you had certain other cases in front of you. There are other cases that are much more useful for you in that position or have much more persuasive power. But still, a nice case to know. What both of these cases emphasize is how important it is to communicate to your clients about the need to do planning and have discussions when they get distributions from their retirement plans. We can do a lot of good for clients if we can know about these things before they take actions that render us unable to fix the problem. Clients need to be aware there are times they should contact you. You need to be proactive in letting your clients know that they need to be dealing with you when cases like this come up. Now, some of you may have noticed last week that we began adding a theme. I picked up from podcastthemes.com a theme package to go ahead and give you some music in and out of the podcast, and we'll have a few other little things that came along with it that we may use otherwise if we find a need to break things up. Podcast Themes offers themes to anybody who's doing a podcast. You basically go to them, pay them for the right to use it, and you know, you get the rights to put it out. Obviously, you can't just go get music from anywhere to plug on your podcast. That's called how to get a letter from the RIAA asking you about what you just did, and you can be finding yourself in a court case you don't want to be in. But as I said, the podcast theme's there, and we're adding that now, and hopefully you enjoy listening to those. This has been the podcast for May 13th, 2006. Our tax update on Section 72T's exception to the distribution penalty prior to age 59 and a half. The Tax Update podcast is intended for those who can do their own research, so please be sure to confirm anything we talked about in this podcast before taking action on behalf of a client. The podcast is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services on the web at www.limebergservices.com. Go ahead and visit Limeburg Information Services to learn about subscribing to their various newsletters, as well as gaining access to their library of tax information. Now, this has been the Tax Update for May 13th, 2006. We'll see you again next week, when we'll take on another tax topic.